Welcome to the GeoMob Podcast, where we discuss geo-innovation in any and all forms, whether for fun or profit.
Welcome back, everyone, to another episode. I have some very good news. I managed to drag Steven away from his vibe coding and get him here on the mic. So we're going to catch up. We're going to share a bit about our projects, and also I'm going to recap last night's very enjoyable GeoMob Berlin. So, Steven, welcome back.
Thank you, Ed. Thank you. And I wasn't actually vibe coding when you scheduled this, but I have been doing a bit of vibe coding. I'm sure we're going to talk about it because I'm now an enthusiast and I think you're a skeptic.
I am not a skeptic, but what I am is, as I just said, I do think the bill will come at some point for the vibe coding. Both in a literal sense, and that I have heard of crazy cases of people burning through all kinds of money, you know, when they're not paying attention, but also in the sense that it's easy to build, it's hard to maintain. And I think a lot of people are building, and it remains to be seen if they're going to be able to maintain these things or if they're just kind of, you know, write once and then throw away kind of tools. So
I'm in favor of write once and throw away.
Okay, fair enough. I think for personal projects that can be fantastic, or you know, immediate tasks that just need to get done. Obviously, in a business sense, we need to be able to maintain the things that we're offering.
Absolutely, absolutely. So let me just give you an example, right? Because of, I mentor two or three people, you know, startups and things like that, and you know, keeping track of what we've talked about, the things that they have committed to working on, sort of maintaining a record of progress against goals, you know, sort of those things, and meeting notes and all of that. I mean, you can do that, and there are loads and loads of ways of doing that. And I was actually thinking for something that I was working on that, well, I need to put together a Google sheet that I can share with the mentee, and then we'll have a tab for this and a tab for that and a tab for the other. And it was a Sunday afternoon and it was raining outside, I think. And I thought, I wonder if I can vibe code something that would work for each of the mentees that I work with and that would give me an overview. So I wrote a prompt and I described what I wanted to achieve. And sure enough, within 10 minutes, I had something. It wasn't what I needed, and it needed an hour or so of iteration. But I actually built something that it's not scalable. And I know all the reasons it's not scalable, because it could only support like working with one or two mentees at the same time and a number of other limitations, which were fine for me. But I actually got a tool which is really useful and is tailored to the way I want to work with the people that I mentor. And that I've now taken my several people through, the people that I mentor through, and yeah, they can also see the benefits of that. Now,
well, this is the dream, right? That you can build the exact tool for your very specific tastes and needs, and you know, which you'll never find on the open market.
Yeah, and I couldn't have done that. I couldn't have written the code for that. You know, it's got some PHP and it's got something else. Yeah, I mean, I do understand what it's doing and how it's doing it, and I understand the data structures and all of that because I've, you know, in the process of building it, we modified the data structure. But you know, it does a nice job for me, and I just think the idea that non-technical people could build tools to do specific to fulfill specific tasks or objectives, without having to go out and pay money for them, that's a pretty cool thing.
Of course, that is very cool, and it does open a lot of room for creativity and things. So, but you know, again, I just wonder if
I'm not suggesting that this is that, you know, you build a business around. Right. I'm not trying to build a mentoring app that I'm going to sell to people. I'm not trying to build something that will support hundreds or thousands of users. I just think it's an interesting opportunity. It's something that I couldn't have done a year ago.
All right. Well, cool. Very cool. Enjoy. Okay. Glad you're liking it. Any anything else on the mapping side? Any updates of your maps in the wild?
Yes, actually there is. I'd forgotten about it. But the whole Mapperry website is built in WordPress, right? And it's now on the large side of a WordPress blog. You know, it's like, I think we're over 2,000 posts and sort of three or 4,000 images. You know, it's pretty big. You know, it's not colossal, and I know there are loads of people who'll be listening who'll say, that's nothing. But it's quite large for a WordPress site. And in WordPress, you use things called themes, which basically provide the visual appearance and styling of the website. And we've been using a theme for a few years, which had been, I don't know what was going on, and I don't know whether it's the caching or the CDNs or what, but we were having a number of problems with the theme displaying the images on the homepage. And it wasn't a disaster, but it was a nuisance and it was unpredictable and we couldn't get to the bottom of it. And when I say we, you know, I'm talking about Arno, who by my standards is a genius. And he couldn't get to the bottom of it. And eventually, Arno had been experimenting with building a new front end for Mapperry, but got bogged down in work and various other commitments and hadn't really progressed it to a point where we could use it. And he did a quick search and said, why don't you try implementing a new theme? So we did, and we implemented a new theme on Mapperry a couple of weeks ago. And took about half an hour to implement it and about another half an hour to sort out one quirky thing that we didn't understand. And we got a lovely new theme running, seems to be running very, very fast. And so if you go to the website now, you'll see it's got a slightly different look and it should be running a lot better.
Congrats. Yeah. Well done.
Job done.
I urge everyone to check it out.
Yeah,
it does seem like WordPress, everyone who uses WordPress eventually gets to this point where they're like, I'm not really sure how it's working anymore, or, you know, like the theme decay or something. I've heard this from every single WordPress user over the years. As you add more plugins and grow the number of posts, and it does seem to
decay. But what I would say in praise of WordPress is that it's an open source CMS, which is highly customizable, configurable, and adaptable. There is nothing that is comparable for non-technical users. It is quite, you know, it's amazing what you can build with WordPress as a non-technical user. I mean, yes, when you get to sort of the size that we are, you probably benefit from having somebody like Arno who can dig into the database and various things. But yeah, I mean, I think WordPress is fantastic. And so does, apparently, so does nearly 30% of the internet.
Okay, well, let's leave it at that before I voice my opinion. But if you're happy, I'm happy. So, all right. Well, either way, congrats on the new theme, and everyone should have a look.
Can I just say it's a hell of a lot easier to work with than Markdown?
Well, yeah. All right. I guess it's, you know, there are different tools for different jobs. So,
so what's going on at OpenCage?
What have we been up to at OpenCage? We've revamped our kind of geo search service, which is the kind of the JavaScript widget that lets people do kind of auto suggest on search. Mm-hmm. So kind of lots of improvements there, both improvements to handling of typos and things, but also we added support for a couple more languages. We added Portuguese and Italian because customers were asking for those. So also some new functionality. So we'll get the blog post linked in the show notes if anyone wants to check that out. We did one bit of bad news. This was a bit annoying, actually, last night at our at GeoMob Berlin. Afterwards, when we were at the pub, you know, I started getting all these notifications on our phone. And apparently, so we host our service with Hetzner, which is a very, very large German hosting company. And we actually have multiple completely redundant locations, right? So even if one location goes down, the other one should be able to carry on. And occasionally that does happen. So occasionally there's some kind of network issue at one location or whatever, and customers usually don't even notice, like, because the other one picks up the slack. Anyway, apparently, all of Hetzner went down last night for about 8 minutes. And so now this morning, they and thus taking us and everyone else at Hetzner down with them. Obviously not the most enjoyable time when you're at the pub trying to a couple geo beers in and you start getting these, but it seems this morning there are some posts that it seems basically they were facing a denial of service attack at Hetzner, and in an attempt to block this, the guy mistakenly blocked everything. So, very unfortunate, and particularly unfortunate because just this week, Hetzner sent an email announcing an increase in prices. So we're going to have to see how we grapple with that. So that's a bit annoying. All the prices are going up, and they're blaming this on, you know, the demand for AI, for new hardware and stuff like that. So enjoy your vibe coding, Stephen, even as it drives my prices up.
Well, funnily enough, I was looking into something to do with Cloudflare. And like, again, a vast number of websites use Cloudflare.
Of course, we use Cloudflare. I mean, for certain services.
Yeah. And they got, I don't know whether they got a denial of service attack or a hack or whatever, but they went down in...
Yeah, it was a couple of months ago, yeah. A
couple of months ago. And sort of you wonder if the biggest providers in the world who are generally considered to be good actors and reliable, which Cloudflare are as far as I understand, if they're getting attacked like this... there's not much you can do about it. You know, I mean, we all try and provide 99.999% availability. But if Cloudflare gets hacked and they're handling your DNS, for example.
Yeah, that's going to be a problem. I agree. At a certain point, all you can do is say, look, we took all reasonable measures and precautions that we could. And, you know, we have redundancy and everything, but.
Redundancy won't help you if the DNS gets hacked.
Absolutely. So, I agree exactly with what you say. Nevertheless, that's not so comforting for our customers, who, of course, were then, you know, they get alerted that our service is down, and so frustrating. Happily, one of our customers was at the bar with us, so, you know, I was able to notify him in person, so... it did come back after, I think we had 8 minutes of downtime. So it's not the end of the world, but it's not great. So
these are the trials and tribulations of running an online business or an online service.
Yeah. What else we got? That's about it. I mean, we're working on all kinds of stuff. Also, you know, playing with the AI and doing things like that. But I mean, one negative side effect of all the AI is, I don't know if you followed this situation, but, we have a security bounty program. So if people find security, you know, we have a webpage that kind of explains these are the kind of security issues we're interested in. And if you report one of those to us, then we'll pay you a small amount. I mean, depending on the severity of the bug, and we actually do that. I mean, I think last year we paid like 4 or 5 bounties. Usually it's very marginal things, but you know, it keeps us on our toes. So, and we have a little hall of fame on our site where people can see this. The problem is, Stephen, it is now, you know, people want to make money. So we get the volume of submissions we've had here is going up, up, up. And people are just sending us basically AI generated crap.
Mm-hmm.
That's just like, you know, your site has this problem, and it'll be like just a complete wall of text. And then when you actually start reading it and dig into it, it's like, no, this is not true. Like, this is not relevant for us or whatever. But it still eats up time.
Yeah.
Of course, to you know, you got to evaluate that and think about it. And the volume is just becoming overwhelming. And actually, quite famously, one of the guys I follow on Mastodon is are some of the people affiliated with the Curl Project. I don't know if you've, you know, this tool. Very long-standing open source tool, very, very widely used. And they had to stop their security branding program because they're just becoming way too much.
But you've also got in the same sort of vein, you've got quite a lot of open source projects
Sure. Are
getting flooded with pull requests.
Yes, that are complete nonsense or not fully thought through or not, yeah. And this, you can see this burns out maintainers, right? Because as I say, you got to think about it, evaluate it, spend time on it. Even if you can, you know, even like in our case where, you know, the overwhelming majority of these security things we can dismiss, but it still eats up time.
I think, I mean, I was chatting online with somebody in the open source community. About this, and the conclusion was that almost certainly there is going to have to be some qualification process to submit a pull request.
Yeah,
you know, you're going to have to either be known, you're going to have to be known to an established committer before you can commit, or in bug search terms, if you've submitted previously a successful bug, that would enable you to submit again. But otherwise, you just won't be able to. It won't be open to everybody. I mean, we're going to become a... If we have to close off our openness to only be open to people that we know or who have been recommended by somebody we know, that may be the fence that we have to put around openness to stop all the AI slop. You know, when I talk about vibe coding, and I'm positive about vibe coding because I'm having a lot of fun doing it and because it's enabling me to do things that I couldn't do otherwise, I'm not in any way denying that vast amounts of slop is being generated by AI, which is just burning energy, wasting people's time, and filling the internet with absolute crap.
Yeah, I agree. We're going to have to figure out something that, I mean, it seems unfortunate to, obviously open source thrives when we get, you know, as many contributions as possible, as many quality contributions as possible. So I guess the issue is how do we ensure the quality? So, but I don't think we're going to solve that one today, Stephen. So
I don't think we should
Shall we dive into the recap of Berlin last night?
Tell me about Berlin, because it looked like a really interesting...
Yeah, I just posted some pictures on the Mastodon account, and it was a great one. The only slight negative is we've become a bit too popular, and so we were at the offices of Up42. You know, who we've had here on the podcast before, and a great office. But we only had capacity for about 60 people or so, 65 people. And so we had to close the sign-up list 2 weeks back before the event because we were going to be way too full. So we're trying to think. My appeal to you, dear listener, is if you know of a larger venue in Berlin that would host us, we need some help there because otherwise we're going to have to keep restricting the size of the events. But I guess that's a good problem to have. And that's also, you know, kind of a testament to how well we've been doing the last couple of years here in Berlin. We great turnout, great mood as always. Lots of regulars now. I mean, there are people who come every single time. Also, of course, lots of new people. It was very fun. So just briefly go through the talks. First up, we had Dave Whittingham, who I've also had on the podcast here a couple of years back. He's a former best speaker winner. And Dave is a very passionate cyclist, long-distance cyclist. And so he and his girlfriend, who's also kind of in that scene, they went on a trip, kind of riding across the Alps. And he told us about how he wanted to build a tool that he could easily capture the memories of this trip, like pictures and kind of little blog posts or whatever, and share it with his friends and parents and family and stuff back home. And of course, doing cool things like, you know, geotagging the photos and putting it on a map and stuff like that. And while he had a lot of fun on this trip, what he learned is his ideas really fell flat because he made the tool way too complicated. And so in the end, and as a result, they couldn't really use it from their phone. They had to get out the laptop, and then they would go on these long bike trips and be too tired to get out the laptop and start to. And so basically the end result is it didn't really work.
Okay.
So then after the trip, he learned from this, and he has since kind of adapted this tool and really simplified it. And he took us through some of the techniques he used of how to try to simplify things and, fall back to more basic technologies that could be used. So it was quite interesting. And the key message was, it was interesting from a technical perspective, but also the key message of learning from your failure. So that was quite good. Second speaker was a woman, who talked about, she's an expert on SAR, what is that, synthetic aperture radar?
Yeah.
You know, this is a type of Earth observation technology. And apologies, let me just look up her name because I don't...
Aisha.
Correct, Aisha. Sorry, I don't have the list in front of me. And I only met her last night for the first time. Anyway, this was very interesting. Talked about using SAR to map flooding in Pakistan, which has the one major benefit versus kind of more visual Earth observations that it works through clouds and it works at night. So, and as a result, you could get the data more quickly or more correctly, and basically providing an additional tool to people trying to manage these kind of conditions, which I don't know if you've ever seen this, but in Pakistan can actually be quite devastating because, all the water flows down from the Himalayas there and can be, I guess, happen quite quickly and stuff. So that was interesting. Next up we had Finn Geiger from Mapular, who are of course one of our sponsors. And Finn is a GeoMob regular, and he told us about This was similar to Dave's talk in that he also emphasized how they learn kind of from failure. And as you may recall, Steve, at the last London GeoMob, we had a talk about DuckDB and how wonderful DuckDB. And so this was an interesting kind of, I don't want to say rebuttal, but
counterpoint.
A counterpoint, exactly, because he talked about they had tried to use DuckDB as a way to visualize massive, massive numbers of POIs. Like imagine every POI in Germany or something like that on a map, and you can kind of zoom in, zoom out. And so a huge amount of data, and then in doing this in a browser and having to load DuckDB first, and basically it didn't really work in that first, when people would come to the site, first they'd have to download all this massive setup. And that would make everything slow. And so then they got rid of DuckDB and tried to kind of build a much simpler solution. And he talked about that solution and some of the learnings that they had there. Of course, every solution has its pros and cons, so it's not perfect. But it in certain situations, it was a vast improvement versus DuckDB in terms of simplicity.
Wasn't the talk we had in London last time not DuckDB? It was something else, I thought.
No, I think it was DuckDB. Am I wrong on this? Am I misremembering? Apologies if that's
I thought it was some cloud. wasn't the point that it was a little cloud, it was a little tool for searching massive cloud databases?
Yes. So, right. But also using DuckDB as a way to do that. So basically the whole thing with DuckDB, if I'm, you know, just to be clear, I'm not a user of DuckDB, but if I understand it correctly, you're kind of loading a database into your browser. So that at that point, your browser has all the capabilities of a full SQL database. But this comes with a high setup cost.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. I've just looked it up. It was Alper, and he was using DuckDB with Spatial and an H3 extension.
Right. So very similar to this project that Finn discussed. Anyway, it was, again, it shows, you know, different tools for different tasks. Mm-hmm. And you always got to be cognizant of who your audience is and what makes sense for them. So, interesting talk. The fourth talk, which then did go on to win the best speaker prize, was Benjamin. Steven, you would have loved this talk. So, it got kind of wild. So, basically, he started showing us these old Ottoman maps, maps of the Ottoman Empire.
Right.
Right, so kind of Turkey, Syria, and you know, some of the challenges there, and you know, first of all, around places have many different names. You might have an Arabic name, a Turkish name, a Kurdish name, and anyway, so he showed us these very beautiful old maps, and some of them were kind of railway maps. And he showed us maps that were kind of like, you know, they would show the railway time between different cities as the railway was introduced, you know, let's say the turn of the last century. But basically, so very quickly, you kind of got this network graph. And I guess that got him thinking, we could digitize this and make an actual network graph. So, which he did. Okay. And then from that, he could build his own Ottoman routing engine, you know, kind of like if in 1900 I wanted to go from Constantinople to you know, what, you know, somewhere on the coast, how would I have gone, how long would it have taken based on this network graph? So, and you know, using all this historic data, and sometimes, you know, the data is good, and then you could also track, for example, how, you know, over a period of a decade or 20 years or whatever, as more railways were built, you know, all of a sudden the travel times kind of changed and it became much, much faster to get to the major cities. Steven, so basically he built his own Ottoman Empire routing engine. And wow. Steven, here's the crazy part though. So I had met him before briefly, but I don't know Benjamin well. And I assumed he was some sort of academic. And this was like an academic research project about, you know, the Ottoman Empire or something. No, it's just his hobby.
Yeah.
His hobby to build an Ottoman Empire routing engine. I mean, crazy.
Yeah, I get that. I get it. Absolutely.
And not just that, but he has an excellent website, which we're going to get into the show notes, where he documents all this. And you can also see some of the maps and things. And, beautiful maps, you know, in kind of an Arabic script and things, and so very cool, very, very cool. And it was clear, no disrespect to any of our other speakers who are all interesting, but it was clear this was the best speaker prize. I mean, you couldn't, in all degrees, I mean, both visually the cartography, but also just the pure geo-geekery of it. So well done to Benjamin.
Very well done. And
But he was not our final speaker. We also had a talk from Ingo from True Metrics, which is a startup here in Berlin. We kind of have a couple, I would say, areas of concentration in the Berlin geo community. On the one hand, we have a lot of Earth observation stuff, but we also have a lot of this last mile delivery. And True Metrics falls into that category. And basically, you know, it's the old idea of actually tracking the delivery guy to see, you know, based on the actual data of the delivery driver, where's the entrance to the building? Where is he parking? Which route is he actually using? And they do this with several several large organizations, postal services and things in various countries. So he took us through some of, obviously, the, interesting visual examples of, the problems they're trying to solve and why this is important and how they're going about doing it. And then also, finally, he posed a question to the audience of what other data they could be gathering and how they go about, how could they better be making use of all the data that they're collecting to better improve the last mile experience. So great talks, great mix.
Great talks.
It was very interesting, every one of them. And yeah, then we went off and, had some beers, which was also very enjoyable. Lots of good conversations.
Can we get Benjamin on the podcast?
We can try. I will propose that. So yeah, this would be a very interesting talk. The only caveat I would have with that is, like, really the talk also stood out visually because seeing the maps, he had quite the collection of very beautiful kind of old maps. So, but it would still be interesting on the podcast. We should try to get him.
And I was reminded, I did a talk on mapping the Holy Land. I think I may have done it at GeoMob a few years ago.
No.
And whilst I was researching that, I was going to the maps collection at the British Library, and I got an introduction through a friend to the historic maps collection at the National Library in Israel as well, where they've got an enormous collection of these. And whilst I was there, I got taken to a seed library, and they've got an enormous archive of seeds from all over the Middle East that they've been collecting for over 100. I think it predates the creation of the State of Israel. And they've got samples of the original wheat seeds, or what's thought to be the original wheat species, and all of that.
Come from the Fertile Crescent kind of.
Yes, exactly. And the reason that they took me, that my host took me there, was this is like a big room with shelves, and on these shelves are thousands and thousands of envelopes. And the envelopes have got some detail on the outside and seeds on the inside. It's very, very basic stuff. It's not sort of super scientific. And in a corner, they've got this massive map chest, or maybe it was two map chests, stuffed full of maps. And the reason that they have them all, which is why it connects to Benjamin's talk, is that because of all the different periods of Middle Eastern history, going back hundreds of years, place names have changed several times. And so when a seed sample got sent in 100 years ago and it said it came from such and such a place, right, they needed a way to actually identify where was that place, where is that place today, because all they had was a textual label. Right, for a place that's name has maybe changed 2-3 times. So these maps are filed not geographically so much, but historically. So they're by era. And literally, the archivists would receive a sample and go through the drawers to find a map of the area and then find the place name on the map.
That's a little manual geocoding.
A little manual geocoding, and I wonder whether Benjamin's maybe come up with, along the way, a gazetteer of historical place names of the Middle East. Because if he has, that would be a very useful tool.
Yes, it would definitely be worth asking about that. We will see if we can get him on the podcast. On a related note, Stephen, we at OpenKids, we were once contacted by a very large genealogy service. And they have also have this challenge of, people have, their old family tree or the family Bible or whatever, where everyone was, their births and deaths were recorded, but often with these very old place names. And they, they've asked us, could you help us geocode these? But, then he sent us a sample and it was really, it was really kind of difficult. It was really problematic in that so many places have, you know, borders have changed and stuff. And then, and even like, you know, we started getting into it with the guy going back and forth on email, and he's like, oh, well, you know, send us, can you at least like send us the country code? And it's like, well, what country code do you want me to put for the Austro-Hungarian Empire? You know, like what, like, I mean, it just doesn't work really. So very, very difficult problem. That would be a fascinating talk, of course, in just its own right. So, all right, yeah. So, but the main takeaway for the listeners is very fun night in Berlin, but we need bigger venues. So please help us. Please let us know where we can have an event that maybe could have 100 people, so we don't have to turn anyone away, because that's a real pity. If people want to attend, and I got several emails from people, you know, at the last minute, of course, oh, I forgot to sign up, you know, can I please still come? And really, yeah, I posted one of the pictures on the Mastodon feed where, you know, really the room was packed. Like, we just couldn't fit more people in. So
yeah, you need a bigger venue, because I'm coming out in the spring, summer too.
Well, our next event is April 22nd. We also need a few speakers for that one, our next Berlin event. So if anyone wants to volunteer to speak, but yeah, I mean, it's going well in Berlin.
Great. Okay.
Well, shall we wrap it up there?
Let's call it a day.
All right. Bye.
Bye.